Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
We had a busy week in Fresno, including...
budget. We have a new budget from the mayor. It is $2.36 billion. It's the highest the city's ever had. And the city's not calling it a hiring freeze, and don't ask them if it's a hiring freeze. They will not like that question.
Are we in semantics games there? What exactly is happening?
It's a little bit complicated. So basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to hold a 6% vacancy rate for all city departments. And so it's not a hiring freeze because if your vacancies are more than 6%, you can fill them. So they are still hiring people. And it's really important from their perspective to not call it a hiring freeze, because they said it means that for the positions they do have open, they get fewer applicants, and you want a big applicant pool. So anyways, that's the semantics of it. It makes sense when you go into the details. There is this question around messaging of the budget, around both the city belt tightening and saying we're holding positions at a 6% vacancy rate, but also we're bonding for a 911 communication center. We are going to have this new pave now, pay later bonding plan that the mayor wants to do to help cover a lot of the city's old roads. Councilmember Miguel Arias had a lot of questions for Dyer on Thursday at the city council meeting around messaging and are we in bad financial straits? Are we not? That's where it is. Omar Rashad on our team has a story coming out soon, just really diving into a lot of the budget detail, as we haven't gotten that many details from the mayor about what's in the budget, so we're hoping to be able to share more of that soon with everyone.
Got it. There was also a settlement with the community health system.
There was.
They're going to have to pay $31.5 million for alleged kickback schemes. What was going on?
Yeah, this is a weird one. So there was a whistleblower complaint by a former employee of one of Community Health System, which is the hospital system that owns Fresno Community Medical Center downtown, Clovis Community Hospital. And they had a whistleblower basically say that they were using community health resources to establish this lounge called HQ2. I have verified that it's there. It's on the corner.
I remember when we were talking about this, and it sounded not real to me, but it's
real.
You've confirmed.
It is real. It is. The court documents have established that it is very real. And basically, they used this lounge as a recruitment tool to get, they would wine and dine physicians in exchange for wining and dining these physicians. The physicians would then refer some of their patients that were eligible for federal healthcare programs like Medicaid and Medicare into the community system. Yes. And this was a cigar lounge and had lots of expensive wines and it had lots of liquor. Now, the whistleblower complaint further goes into even more detail that we didn't have in our story, where they actually, there was allegations of trips to Las Vegas that included strippers and even more alcohol. So there was a lot happening on the company dollar that the U.S. government did not find favorable and therefore asked for the settlement to be paid.
So Fresno has this new thing I'm really excited about, these Lego kind of modular construction buildings for affordable housing. I know that there was a lot of pushback from unions when they had a similar project in San Francisco.
Yeah.
How is this being received and what should we know about it?
It hasn't been that. So it's modular housing. Basically, you build offsite at a factory, and then once all of the materials are shipped to the site, it's just a matter of piecing it all together like Legos. Some of you may be familiar with the Sears kit homes that were built at the last turn of the century. Anywho, there's a affordable housing project in Northwest Fresno that's currently under construction, almost complete, that is being built in this modular way. But outside of that, it hasn't, outside of like accessory dwelling units where people put a prefab house in their backyard, it hasn't really been received very broadly by Fresno developers yet. There's a little bit of risk, as Pablo talked about in his story. A lot of lenders are unsure about the quality of the housing, and so there's more risk in their view to finance these projects. So that's one reason why you're not seeing a lot more of it.
Don't you, is that could be relationships with developers there that do traditional kind of framed housing as opposed to modular housing? Or do you think that's not a factor?
That was not something that Pablo found in his reporting. It could certainly be an issue, but it wasn't one that came up. Another thing that came up that the head of the Fresno Housing Authority told Pablo, our reporter on this, is that while it is somewhat cheaper to build modular housing, it's not vastly cheaper in his view, based on some of the calculations that they've done at the Fresno Housing Authority. So
I'm sure that's scalability, though. It's not something that's widely used. And so if it comes to scale, I'm sure it could
possibly
be.
Yeah. So for all of those reasons, it's why it hasn't seen a lot of uptick in Fresno. But that could change. We have local prefab contractors that are willing and able to step into the game. And so the city is certainly really interested in this idea. The city's housing director, Phil Sky, was quoted in the piece just really optimistic about this as a construction construction method, but we'll see if it picks up more steam.
What does modular housing do to your urban planning heart? Does that get you excited for dress? No? Okay.
We'll I don't have feelings about you have, modular
you
housing.
You don't have feelings about modular housing?
I really don't. As long as it looks, I think as long as the quality is there and the aesthetics are fine. There are some labor arguments to be made, sure, about this, but it's not like we have the best labor practices building a lot of the housing that we do anyway in the first place. Hey. Other headlines, we had City Attorney Andrew Jans on the podcast a few weeks ago talking about the need potentially for more campaign finance reform in Fresno. And as it turns out, our reporter Omar Rashad learned that Fair Political Practices Commission is the state's political watchdog, and they actually have launched a formal investigation into Alex Tavlian, who's the local political operative who was behind this sort of what we call dark money mailer against Councilmember Brandon Vang a few weeks ago or a few months ago now in the race to represent District 5. So we'll find out what happens with that investigation, but it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, what could the consequences be?
Fines, okay. Usually. On today's podcast, we have the new superintendent of Fresno Unified, officially Misty Herr. She's the first woman and Hmong superintendent of the state's third largest school district. We're excited to have her on. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So we're going to start. We have many things that we want to talk to you about, but the first sort of area of topics is really going into this question of enrollment and attendance. I know this is something that the district has talked about a lot. You mentioned recently that some of the enrollment issues that the district is facing, we've seen a decline since the pandemic, is really around this lack of developers willing to build housing in Fresno Unified specifically, and that we're just not seeing as much housing growth. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how much that's contributing to enrollment versus other factors around inter-district transfers, inter-district transfers, people diverting out of the school system to other options.
I think there's a lot of factors that play into enrollment. We are landlocked, Fresno, and so we can't build unless we take over or we start to build up. Since the pandemic, we haven't been able to bounce back. And I think it's not something that's just unique to Fresno. It's a lot of school districts that I work with across our nation. It's something that we're dealing with. And it's just a lot of factors. The immigration, the recent immigration executive orders have also had an impact. Just things that I think also different ways in which students are learning and families are opting for different modalities in which they're learning has contributed. So like for me to pinpoint and say, hey, it's this one thing, I don't think it is. I think it's a culmination of like many different things that's contributing to that.
How do you think declining enrollment will impact student services?
We are a district that we get our funding based off of enrollment and average daily attendance. And yeah, it is going to impact supports and services that we have. We are going to have to make cuts. We are making cuts right now. And so that is going to be a big factor. Am I worried about it? I am, but I also think that as we are going through all of this, like the rest of all the districts that are facing this in California and across the nation, it also gives us opportunities to really look at the work that we're doing. I just met with my team this week and we talked about what are the things that we are doing that are working really well, and then what are things that we really need to cut, and how do we make like really informed data and informed decisions about those types of things, which is something that we're not used to, because with the funds from the pandemic, we did get a lot of funding, and so people are very used to that. And we've always, even though we said from the very beginning that's going to go away, it's hard when it's going away and people have to actually make cuts.
You've put a lot of initiatives out into the world over the last couple of years around boosting attendance, sprints, just being very visible, your public presence about the importance of attendance. What's worked and what hasn't worked, and how are you trying to pivot those strategies?
What we have found that has really worked is there's no substitute for the relationship that an educator has with a student. And where we see that students are really coming to school is when students find that someone at school really cares about them. And we monitor our attendance on a daily basis, and I'll get the reports, and I'll call schools that are doing really well. And it is because every time a child is absent, someone's following up. Hey, you haven't been to school in 2 days. We missed you. When are you going to come back? That really makes a big difference versus we let days and days go, and then people feel like they're just forgotten. So we know that's the number one factor that gets our students to and families to come to school. It's a place where they feel welcome and where they feel like they belong. And then there are other factors like illnesses that have contributed to it. I know like the immigration things that have contributed a lot. I personally have spoken to families who are worried and they're afraid. They don't want to be separated from their children. Just a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to a family who normally they're working and they're going according to the crops, right? And they would be in Salinas right now. And normally their children would be here under the care with some relatives while they're gone. Well, they don't feel comfortable now. And the kids haven't been in school. We checked in on them. That's because the parents have decided we're going to take the kids. We'll be back, but we just don't want the kids to stay without us. Normally, they would be under the care of an aunt or somebody. So it's those types of dynamics that there's just different factors that we're dealing with.
The hospitality thing is such a different perspective than like SARB or like policing truancy. Like that just does not work. Mm-hmm. And I think giving people that frame of reference really makes a lot of sense in order to like think about that you have a role to play in a student's attendance, not just your receptacle for their attendance.
If we think about like why did we go to school as kids? Why did I go to school? I went to school because I wanted to interact with my friends, but I also had teachers who like created like just really awesome learning that I didn't want to miss. And I think one of the things that people have asked me, what's going to bring people, families back to Fresno. And we have a lot of transfers into Fresno because of the programs that we have. But if we want people to come and stay in Fresno, they have to really think about the experiences. We have to think about the experiences that our families are experiencing when they go through our system.
And how do you articulate this to families maybe that have a child that's truant? Because they also have a role to play. They're a stakeholder in this.
No, it's equally important, right?
Yeah.
I was sharing with staff because, again, we monitor attendance. So every once in a while, I try to, on a weekly basis, try to make at least one home visit. And like I'll pull up our chronically absent kids and I'll just show up and they're like, what are you doing here? Why is your superintendent here? And then
it's gotta be really surprising to see you at the front door.
Yeah, and I'm just, hey, you haven't been in school in a couple of days. When are you coming back? And then the first time you show up, they're like, oh, she's gonna go away. And then you show up again. And then you show up again, and by the third time, it's, I told you I used to go to school because your superintendent's going to show up again. And then just this morning, but on my way to school, I stopped at a school because two kids promised me they were going to come by school. And so I stopped by and I said, hey, all right, here you go. Here's your two stickers I promised you. But it's not so much that I don't expect that everybody do what I'm doing. One, I do it because it fills my bucket. Yeah. It fills my bucket. I like doing that. I like seeing our kids. But two, now there's a relationship. And more than anything, the kids know my superintendent actually really cares about me and will come to my school to check on me.
But there's so many kids who I would presume are also in that situation, and you can't be always there. So how do you
delegate this kind
yes,
of leadership?
Yes, delegate, bring up the yeah. culture of, mm-hmm. of the people that you work with so that they're wanting to do that as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things where in one of our like goals and guardrails, we have a guardrail around health and wellness. And that is really like, what it's saying is that everyone is responsible for the health and wellness of our students and our employees. And it's not just, like you said, there's 70,000 students. There's no way I'm going to be able to make 70,000 home visits. But I think what it is that if every single, there's 10,000 of us, if every single person cares enough to just, and I'm not saying you go to their home, but like notice that a child hasn't been in school, or if they're out on the field, ask them how they're doing. Or when as they're entering our gates, say hi to our kids. It's those, I think those simple little acts, and we know how we feel when we arrive to a school site and whether someone someone greets us or not automatically gives us the feeling of how we feel about the school. And that's the thing that I'm really trying to impart on everyone, is that it doesn't matter your role, it doesn't matter who you are and what you do for the district, you have a place to play in the lives of our students.
Let's transition to talk about English language development, or ELD. I find that English language learners, to use that term, are often the most misunderstood community in our schools. Oftentimes people confuse verbal ability with intelligence. How are you going to reframe or reshape how we think about English language development in Fresno Unified?
Yeah, when you label and you use that word English learner, it sounds so like that the person doesn't know anything. And for me, I use it as our students, our English learners are actually very linguistically gifted. Mm-hmm. And I call them, they're our linguistically gifted learners. I was that child. And I always tell people, just because our students sometimes come to us not having the necessary resources or supports in place, they may be poor in supports and resources, but they're not poor intellectually. And so I don't like to think of our students in that way. I think that we have, there's assets, there are things, there's a gift to knowing another language. And I know for sure, knowing another language, there's been things that I have been able to do and understand that other people have not been able to do. Who can quickly translate two languages in my head and then quickly speak English and speak Hmong and still, and I understand a little bit of Spanish too, right? And so that for me, it's not a detriment, actually, it's an asset.
I love every year at graduation, those kids that get the seal of biliteracy. Yeah. It's one of my favorite awards that we can give to a kid who is proficient in more than one language.
And I always tell people, I say, okay, you're not really, I tell our students and they were like, they sometimes do a double take when I say, you're linguistically gifted. You're not just learning English, you're linguistically gifted. The fact that two languages, that's a gift that you're going to have that no one else has.
How does that flip of terms and a reframe of that structure, how does that infiltrate the way that teaching staff, that on-site staff approach the way that we improve outcomes for a lot of these students?
So like when you think about working with our students who are learning English, when a child is in your class, it's just because they don't understand yet. That word yet, right? Yeah. And so it's your job as the educator to make sure that you scaffold and you front load enough information so they understand what they're reading. So I'll give you an example. Someone gave me a passage to read a couple of weeks ago on cricket. I have no clue what cricket is. Don't
the
know.
Game.
The game, cricket. Yeah, yeah. Like, I've never played it. Don't even know what it is. And so I'm reading the passage and I'm like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I have no clue what it is. But as soon as the person front-loaded for me, oh, this is a game that is playing in this way. This is what you play with it. This is how you play with it. They showed me pictures of it, took out a video, showed me what the video is. All of a sudden, I go and I read the passage, and now I have full understanding of what it is. So what we're asking for is we're just saying, front load enough information so when the student reads a passage or they're trying to understand it, they have the same level of understanding like someone else who already has that background knowledge.
I'd love to transition into talking a little bit more specifically about the goals you have around student outcomes mm-hmm. and achievement. You're entering this role as superintendent as a 30-year veteran of the district. This is where you've grown up in your career, and presumably you don't have a lot of just longtime colleagues, but certainly friends that you work with as well. And you have these very ambitious goals, a 30% jump in reading proficiency for first graders just being one of them. And I'm curious how you think about what you can do in your new leadership position with a lot of the sort of institutional knowledge you have that is a shift from your predecessors. And how do we make these really intense shifts in the achievement goals with a lot of the same people who have been in the district for a long time?
Yeah, and actually people have said you're part of the problem because you've been in the district for a long time and there's been no changes. And I was like, so have you. you've been a part of the district for a long time too, and you've not made any changes too. So let's all get our hands dirty and let's make this work. And basically, I love the goals. I think that for a long time, people have said Fresno Unified, we don't know where the ship is going because it's turning in so many different directions. And for the first time, we're actually turning in one direction. So what parent doesn't want their first grader to read, to be able to read? What parent doesn't want their child to come in into our system? And if they're a little below, then we got to catch them up. And then once we catch them up, then we have to accelerate them. And then to graduate college and career ready, right? I want to be able to go to college and not have to take any remediation courses. And then for us to give them life skills that is going to allow them to thrive in a world where we don't even know what careers are going to be out there for them. And so those are really important goals. I think the hard part is now shifting the adult mindset, because we say we want focus, but in actuality, we don't want focus. Because when we have focus, it means that we're going to be held accountable. We're going to be held to certain standards, certain expectations. And when we have a lot of goals and we're going in so many different directions, I personally feel that people actually want that more than the focus, because then you can hide behind a lot of things and you can have a lot of excuses. There is no excuses. Like when people talk about what I want to do the next 3 to 5 years as superintendent, it's very clear. Get 80% of our first graders to read, make sure every child gets caught up and accelerate, and make sure that when we graduate our students, they're ready for the work world.
Yeah. Let me ask more specifically then, what is the mechanism of change? So you talked about a mindset change, but is it more support for teachers? Is it smaller classes? How do we actually achieve this now that we've set the path?
Yeah, because I think that like we're always looking for that, what's that silver bullet? And there is no silver bullet. The silver bullet is already in us, for us to go and figure it out. So if let's just take the first goal of getting all of our first graders, 80% of our first
graders. I'm so glad.
So then as a parent, when you enroll your child in our system, what are those guarantees that you are going to be, that we're going to be able to guarantee for our students? And so the ability to say, when you enroll, so I'll give an example of my niece is going to be going into kindergarten. When my niece finishes kindergarten, it's an expectation that she knows how to read this many high frequency words. She's at this level in leveled readers when she's reading. She knows how to blend vowel, consonant words. And right, and so that should be very clearly defined about when your child walks in at the beginning of the year, we expect them to be at this level. By the middle of the year, they should be at this level. And by the end of the year, when they exit, they should be at this level so that then they're ready for first grade. So it should, those things need to be very clear, because what we have right now is we have one school that says your child in kindergarten only needs to know 30 high frequency words. And then we have another school that says your child needs to know 200 words. Look at the difference. Yeah. Between the child who has to only know 30 words and the child who has to know 200 words, right? And so it's building. One thing that we're going to do is go back to the basics in the district. What are those basic foundational reading skills that every single child needs to know? So get the basics down, get the measurements. What are we going to measure? How are we going to measure it? And then when are we going to publicly report it out so that everybody sees it? That's going to be really important. And so when you say, okay, then all that sounds really easy, right? And then every child should be progress monitored so that we know exactly where like little Misty is and what we need to do to make sure that Misty stays on grade level. That all sounds really easy until we have to actually do it, because the people who have to go do it, when you're trying to have a debate around should they know 200 words or should they know 30 words or should they know 50 words.
So much time spent on what target you're aiming, right, as opposed to just getting to work.
And for me, I'm just like, yeah, of course they need to know 200 words. Why wouldn't they have to know 200
right.
words? If you had to choose between 30 and 200, 200.
Let's talk about reading. So I'm sure you're familiar with the Mississippi Miracle, the explosion of the science of reading across the United States, which is funny because everything goes in cycles in education. So how do you think about what needs to be done to bring our kids up to the level in each grade?
I think that like our standards, our state standards clearly call out what our students need to know and be able to do. So I don't think it's like an either or, like you either do this or you do that. I think it could be a both and.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we need to teach our students how to read. And we also at the same time need to put in their hands very rich, rigorous, complex texts so that they can enjoy what they're reading. And what I think about is, I just think about like when I'm working with imagine like if you're a child and you're only given leveled readers, which is the very to read all the time, and you never get rich literature in your hands. How are you ever going to enjoy reading if you don't have those, mm-hmm. that very rich, very complex text that you can think through and you can have discussions with? And a lot of people will say to me, you can't do that with kindergartners.
Yes, you can.
Absolutely can.
My daughter's a kindergartner. I'm seeing it in action. It's amazing.
Yes, it is amazing. And you absolutely can. It's just like the debate that I'm having with people who go, oh, we're building what we call a portrait of a learner. And it's like skill sets that we want, life skills that we want our students to have. And we're having this robust conversation just the other day about we can't do it in transitional kindergarten or in kindergarten. I'm like, yes, we do. We already do it when we say to five little TK kids, hey, you have to all share this toy. So you got to figure out who takes a turn, when, how, and how you're going to go about doing it. That's the simplest way in which we do it. Because if we don't build it then and we wait until they finish or they're in high school, those skills should be built from the very beginning.
I want to hear a little bit more about the portrait of the learner that you said that you guys are building. So much of our system is really focused on SBAC, math and reading, mm-hmm. math and English language arts. How are you thinking about preparing students who graduate, not just to pass those tests and to have college readiness, but to also be ready for a vastly changing world, AI?
Artificial intelligence, yep.
Yes, all the things. Exactly. Yeah. The world that they're graduating into is just so different than the world that we graduated into.
That is really important. And we have to teach students how to read and write and listen and speak and do math. And that is really critical. But when I started this role as interim superintendent, the very first groups that I went to were students. And the students told me a lot. They don't hold back. They will tell you a lot of things. But there was one group that really it really made me just feel like, oh my gosh, we failed these kids, right? I asked a question, and it was a group of students who had already graduated from us for a while, and they were actually in the work world. And I said, where did we fail you as a district? And they said, you really want to know? And I'm like, I absolutely want to know. Where do we fail you? And this is what they said. You taught me how to read, you taught me how to write, you taught me how to do math and all that, but you did not teach me what it was going to be like when I went into the work world and I had to work with 10 other people to complete a project. And that I didn't realize that I had to collaborate and I had to do critical thinking skills and I had to criticize other people's work. And when my work got criticized, that to not take it personally, but that it was going to actually help me become better. Those were the skills. And one gentleman told me, he said, Mrs. Herr, I think if I had known what you were talking about right now, all the creativity, collaboration, thinking, critical thinking and problem solving skills, I wouldn't have been fired 3 times before I landed on this job and learned the hard way. And I think that's why like we are building the portrait of a learner, and we have a goal around life skills, and we don't know what that looks like yet. Like our other 3 goals, we're pretty sure, like we're very concrete on what we're going to use, how we're going to measure it. But the life skills one, we're still fleshing out, because we are building like what are those competencies that we really want our students to walk away with. And most places will build a portrait of a learner for like high school. We're actually building it for K-12. And the reason being is like what I said, we have to teach it starting the moment our students enter our system.
Last question for you. It's about community schools. And I've worked at them. I know what they're like. They provide amazing services to kids who are not getting them at home. One challenge I see is how do we maintain our focus on academics when our schools are offering so many different services? You have so many specialists and support staff pulling students out of classes for different things. Like, how do we keep our eye on the ball of academics as well?
Yeah, that's been very difficult. And I have to say that because like for the last 5 years, we've been working on what's called academic return on investment. And it is really looking at what are the most important things that we need to prioritize, because too much of a good thing is not a good thing for our students. And so do I love community schools? Absolutely, because it is wraparound services and supports. But a child can We can't do it at the risk of them missing prime instructional time. And that's a conversation that it's a struggle that I have all the time, like with our staff, because everybody, our instructional division wants to do all this really great, high quality teaching and learning that happens in the classroom. But if a kid is always being pulled out, and I'm not saying the social emotional supports are not needed, they absolutely are. But like, how much becomes too much for a child?
Yeah. I would say another question I have on community schools is what I noticed or saw the reporting that Fort Miller is through community schools helping provide some housing vouchers to families. Mm-hmm. Amazing. So glad that they'll be in walking distance to affordable housing in the school. And that's a role that cities and counties have historically played in the housing authority. And so how do you define the line between schools providing a service because the community has failed and pushing back on those institutions to do better by our community?
I've always said this, it should not be dependent on just the district to take responsibility for our children. It's everyone. And it's just like when people say, you guys are a failing district. If we all want us to get better, then everybody has to come in, right? And everybody has to get their hands dirty. The fact that we have to also provide vouchers for students, that for me is just, okay, come on, you know, like come alongside us, right? Because we're having to do, and that's important, and we're gonna do whatever it takes to get our kids, to get them to school, to get them so that they can learn. But at the same time, like I'm just tired of like people saying, criticizing, and then not doing anything about it to help us.
Yeah, it's always Maslow's before Bloom's, right?
Yeah,
yeah, it's super important. We close these podcasts in the same place every week with what we're loving this week. Missy, what are you loving this week?
I am loving this book that I'm reading, and okay. It's called Let Them.
Okay.
Oh, I've read about, is this yeah, from tell, Mel
tell
Robbins?
Us, it is, yeah, tell us about it.
It's a whole new way of thinking, and I think it's really orienting me differently to the way people think about me. And people are going to, ever since I stepped into this role, it has become such a judgmental role. I say something and people are mad. I don't say something and people are mad. And then I'm just standing in line and I'm thinking out loud and people all of a sudden start moving. Oh, she said this. And I'm like, I was just thinking out loud. And this book has really helped me to reframe and to think about what are the most important things that I want to go after. And then everything else is noise.
Fantastic.
I love that.
Donnie, what are you loving this week?
So I'm not a morning person. I never have been. But I don't know. My husband is a morning person, and he's been pushing me for years and years. Just set your alarm clock like a little bit earlier. And I don't do alarm clocks, like full stop. I don't do alarm clocks. But this week I've been getting up at 6, and it's beautiful.
Oh.
And I need a lot of transition time before I start my day. So I just sit on my couch at 6 with my coffee, and I stare out the window, and I don't do anything for 30 minutes.
That's fantastic. And mine is actually on the same note. I love my coffee roaster. I've started roasting beans at home.
That's
and I
the
order
best.
Them in bulk. And I just have fresh coffee every week. And I've got giant bags of green beans that I order from Oakland. And it's my favorite thing. So I was roasting yesterday just thinking about...
Love that.
I just love that I do this at home.
You just love the smell of it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
My wife has me do it in the garage because it can be overpowering. But yeah. Aside from that.
Yeah.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.